Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from the hospitals of HealthQuest and HealthQuest Medical Practice, physicians offering primary and specialty health care in private office settings throughout the Hudson Valley. 1-888-525-HQMP or 4767 for appointments.
Hello and welcome back, everybody, to the Vox Pop WMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Dr. Alan Boulos. Dr. Boulos is the chair of the neurosurgery department at Albany Medical Center. He specializes in the surgical and endovascular management of cerebrovascular disorders of the brain, that's stroke, aneurysm, vessel stenosis, and AVM. He also has expertise in surgery for brain tumors. Dr. Boulos earned his medical degree from Albany Medical College, where he also completed his internship and residency. He also completed a fellowship in endovascular neurosurgery at Millard Fillmore Hospital in Buffalo. He's a member of the American College of Surgeons, the American Heart Association, the American Association of Neurological Surgeons, the Congress of Neurological Surgeons, and the Society of Neurointerventional Surgery. You have a question? I'll bet you do. For Dr. Boulos, 1-800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Okay, so everybody's going to ask me what AVM is. That's one of your specialties. What is that?
An AVM is an arterial venous malformation. It's an abnormal connection between the arteries which bring the blood to the brain and then the veins which drain the blood from the brain. Normally, the connection is through a capillary where oxygen is exchanged, but in these cases, there is no connection, and the problem is that the vein is seeing the blood flow at a very high pressure, like an artery. And that results in changes that carry the risk for seizures, bleeding, headaches, and on evaluation, we then have to make decisions on how to treat that patient.
And what is the evaluation method we're using now? In other words, somebody comes in complaining of a terrible, terrible headache. You know, they're sent to you, you're going to have what, a PET scan, or what do you do?
So the best non-invasive technology today is using CAT scan, usually for the detection of blood, and something called a CT angiogram. So the newest CAT scans can actually look at the vessels of the brain, and we can diagnose the aneurysm or the AVM in the emergency room right when it happens. The other technology that's become very important is MRI, which doesn't use radiation and doesn't carry the risk of contrast that the CAT scan might. Mm. And that has provided excellent visualization as well of the blood vessels of the brain or of the brain itself looking for tumors or other problems.
So when we all started putting cell phones up to our ears, there was a spate of people who said, wait till you see the cancer rate go through the roof. Have we?
No, it's a very controversial topic. It's thought to be non-ionizing radiation, so the risk is not thought to be as significant. But they continue to look at population changes in cancer rates, and it's going to take a while to sort out whether cell phones can carry some risk or not. Yeah. But as of now, there doesn't appear to be.
Interesting. So we hear about different brain tumor types. Could you give us just a little bit of a tour?
So brain tumors, in a very generic way, the most common brain tumor is one that comes from somewhere else in your body called a metastasis, so from the lung or the kidney. And in adulthood, that's the most common brain tumor. Within brain tumors themselves, however, there are some that come from within the brain substance itself, and that's can be a very aggressive brain cancer type, which is called glioblastoma. And there are lots of benign brain tumors where surgery can be curative, the most common of which is acoustic neuroma, which can affect the hearing apparatus and the balance apparatus, as well as meningiomas, which are tumors that grow from the covering of the brain and usually affect us later in life.
Are they always fatal, these major cancers, or you said the others are curable, the non-cancerous ones, but if you have blastoma, can you be cured?
So glioblastoma carries a very difficult prognosis. The risk is high of dying within 5 years, but in every study, there's always an outlier or two where patients have survived many years after. And to some extent, the medical community even goes back to look if that diagnosis was correct to begin with. But having said that, there are cases, and always there in every report, cases of that, but they are very uncommon, unfortunately.
We'll go to Matt in Rosendale. Okay. Welcome back, Matt. What do you got?
Hi, Alan. It's your friend, Matt. I wanted to ask the doctor about, I had a subdural hematoma, and it was a couple of weeks after a triple bypass, and I didn't know anything except that I had a really bad headache, the worst headache I could imagine. And I went to the hospital, and they took pictures and found that that's what it was. Now, since then, that was over a year ago, I've been having headaches. How do I know when I need to go to the ER? Because, you know, I have headaches pretty regularly now, and some of them get pretty bad. I'll hang up and listen.
No, don't hang up. Don't hang up. Don't hang up. We may need to ask you a question. Go ahead, Doc.
That's a good question. So a subdural hematoma is a blood that collects on the surface of the brain between the covering of the brain called the dura and the brain substance itself. And it can happen from fairly mild trauma, things that you wouldn't expect, hitting your head on the car door or something like that. Often it's associated also with blood thinners. So if you're on a blood thinner, such as with cardiac surgery, you might have been on a blood thinner at the time of the surgery. That makes you more prone to the development of those blood clot collections. In terms of the management of a blood clot like that, there are only a couple choices. One is surgery, where you drain it. The method of drainage can be different. Sometimes it's a small hole. Sometimes it's a craniotomy where the opening is larger, depending on the clinical situation. Your question
about...
Yeah,
Doc, I had the craniotomy.
Okay, and that's usually very effective at removing the blood clot and preventing it from coming back. Unfortunately, with subdurals, though, they can come back despite our best efforts. And so somebody who has increasing headaches, increasing severity of headaches, should be re-imaged to make sure that that's not the case. Unfortunately, you can also suffer from headaches after surgery even without a subdural being there. So it's always good to be safe and check. And once you're assured that these headaches are not from a subdural, then you can feel better about managing it with medications and not having to come to the emergency room.
Great question, Matt, and I thank you for calling, and I hope you feel better, okay?
Thank you.
Bye. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll be back. We'll have lots of time to talk to you. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551.
Support comes from Ellis Medicine, providing comprehensive inpatient and outpatient healthcare in Schenectady and Southern Saratoga counties. EllisMedicine.org. Theaters Book Center, featuring permanent and visiting exhibits, public and group tours, educational programs, films, concerts, performances, and more. Open Sunday through Friday, 10 to 4, YiddishBookCenter.org. The Dutchess County Fair in Rhinebeck, August 25th through 30th, featuring the Distinctly Dutchess Pavilion, products grown, made, and manufactured in Dutchess County and the Hudson Valley, DutchessFair.com. And from Gothic Inn, Block Island, Rhode Island, a Victorian bed and breakfast perched high overlooking Crescent Beach. A short walk from the town and the ferry, dogs are welcome, TheGothicInn.com.
We are back with Dr. Alan Boulos, the chair of the neurosurgery department at Albany Medical Center. And we're very delighted to have you here, sir. Let me ask you first, a big word on everybody's mind now is stroke. Everybody worries about stroke, heart attack and stroke. Anything new?
Yeah, so this year there's been a real revolution in the way we take care of stroke patients. There's been three randomized trials that have all shown a benefit to patients who've had a large vessel occlusion, which is one of the major arteries going to the brain gets blocked off by a blood clot either from the heart or from the carotid artery and lodges within the brain and causes the stroke, which means that you're paralyzed or unable to speak. There's new technology now where we place a stent into the artery, and with the stent open, we drag that stent out of the carotid artery, and that takes the clot with it. And so in the end, we leave nothing in place and are able to reopen these vessels.
What exactly is the carotid artery again?
The carotid artery are two major arteries that emanate from the chest, go through the neck, and up into the brain, and they divide and supply the front 70% of our brain with blood flow. So they're very important vessels.
Okay, and now we've been doing stents with hearts for years, so we're just applying this to now to stroke?
Yeah, so yes, for acute myocardial infarction, stenting is the mainstay of treatment. And as I mentioned, my training was in Buffalo, where we used to use stents in the brain, but we had to leave the stents behind, as they did in the heart. What the real evolution was, making these stents specifically designed for the vessels of the brain, so they're softer, more able to navigate into the brain vessels. And by leaving it open and dragging it out of the body, we don't have to implant it, and we actually can get more of the clot out than with the old way of just implanting the stent.
Is this becoming universal treatment for everybody, or is Albany Med leading the way, or how's that working?
So at Albany Med, we have three neurosurgeons that do the endovascular surgery, Dr. John Delfino, Dr. Junichi Yamamoto, and myself. And we're the only ones in the capital region that do that kind of treatment. So it's really time is of the essence for these patients. We really try to do every minute counts. And part of the problem with these trials showed that it was such a time-sensitive procedure that if you waited too long, that the benefit was lost.
So you came into the emergency room. How long do you have? I mean, people say it's 4 minutes for a heart attack. How long do you have, do you think? What's your estimate with a stroke?
So in trauma, they call it the golden hour. In stroke, it's probably minutes. So every minute, you lose 2 million neurons and and all the connections. It's a very bloodthirsty organ because it has all the electrical connections it has to maintain. So really, there is no absolute number. And that was another revolution for us, is that we image the brain when someone comes into our emergency room to look at what area of the brain still could be saved by the treatment. And that's critical to getting those patients off to the angio suite to have that procedure.
Well, it sounds like if I were a real estate agent, I'd be selling as much real estate around the Albany Medical Center as I could, considering the fact that you have such a short time before you're done. Well, I mean, I live near a hospital, Fairview Hospital in Great Barrington, Little Fairview, but they don't have you.
Right. So when I mentioned the large vessel occlusion, there are lots of patients with a stroke whose large vessel is not occluded, and this procedure won't work for those patients.
I see.
It's specific to the most severe stroke patients.
I see.
The windows that they looked at was 6 hours from the onset of stroke. So when the symptoms begin to when we open the vessel, these trials allowed patients to be entered within 6 hours of that stroke onset. Now, having said that, you don't have 6 hours to do it. You really want to do it as soon as possible because you're losing patients and the benefit to patients as you get closer to 6 hours.
Sure.
Every minute counts. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't, it doesn't mean you have to live next to Albany Med, but the quicker you get that treatment, the quicker you get that care.
Well, we got a lot of people important on the phone, but I wanted to ask you something, Alan. How many, how strong, how old, let me try it this way. How old do you have to be to when your risk increases?
For stroke?
Yes. You're being asked that by a 74-year-old.
So the truth is stroke affects everyone, and children as well. And we do these procedures every year in children. So it's kind of a myth that stroke only affects the elderly. It does affect the elderly. And if you looked at our numbers, certainly there's more in the 60s, 70s, and 80s that have stroke than in their teenage years. But stroke affects everyone. It affects people in their 30s and 40s. The cause can be different. And so the treatments sometimes are different, but nobody is immune to it. And as soon as symptoms develop, getting help is important.
Last question. Do you take a baby aspirin every night?
I do not, but I do highly recommend it. There are physicians who call it vitamin S, and it's not necessarily wrong to take it.
Okay. Let's go to Tim in Ballston Spa. Okay, Tim, you're on. Go.
Yeah, I was just curious about an incident that I had probably 10 to 15 years ago. At that time, I had a coffee maker at the head of my bed, and I rolled over and turned on the coffee maker with my left hand. And later on, after the coffee was made, I think I poured it with my left hand and then sat back and reached over with my right to drink it, and I could not pick it up. It was shaking in my hand. My hand felt extremely weak, and I don't think I felt anything really. But then I got out of bed, and I found that my right leg felt funny. And as I walked, it almost felt like the leg was springing off the ground as I walked. And I walked straight to the bathroom and took two aspirin. And about 2 or 3 hours, well, I'll say 2 hours later, the symptoms were gone. I had gone to the Albany Medical Center emergency room, and they gave me a CAT scan and ultrasound and whatever, and found nothing.
Okay, so because there are five people on the phones, the question, I take it, is, you know, what was happening,
what,
right?
What would you say that experience was?
Well,
somebody said something about an ischemic stroke or something.
Yeah, it sounded like a stroke. The description of trying to put the coffee in the right hand and finding it tremulous and heavy, that's classic for weakness. Now, weakness can be from other things, but the fact that your leg also affected in a similar way really sounds like it could have been a stroke. And fortunately, you had something called the TIA, or transient ischemic event. Transient just means that the time was short. And so you recovered, maybe because you took the two aspirin, maybe it would have gotten better on its own. But in either event, fortunately for you, things got better. And as you did, you went to the hospital anyways, because the key with people who have had TIAs is it could be a warning sign of the big stroke to come. Mm. And so it's very important to get the workup to make sure that we're not missing a blockage either in the carotid artery or a heart rhythm that's abnormal. That is critical to be done very quickly, because what we call the recurrent risk of stroke with TIA is high. And so fortunately for you, it didn't happen. So,
okay, Tim, we're going to let you go. We got a lot of people behind you.
Bye.
Thanks so much for calling. All right, we'll go to Ed in Kingston. Okay, Ed, you're on.
Hi, thank you. I have, a congenital condition of calcium deposits up and down my spinal cord. Had my first MRI years ago, and it kind of looks like the Alps. And so I have, and it was pressing on the spinal cord to the point where my feet and hands were starting to get numb. And so I had a spinal, they roto-rooted out and did a spinal fusion of C2 and 3. And that cleared it up for a couple of years. The symptoms recurred. I had a spinal fusion of C6, 7, and 8. And that didn't do a whole lot to ameliorate the symptoms. They ameliorated a little bit. That was probably 8 years ago. My symptoms are starting to recur. I'm getting the numbness in my fingertips again, although not in my feet. And I'm just wondering whether, I guess two things I'm wondering is, one, at this point, I'm noticing the symptoms, but they're certainly not serious. I'm not too concerned. They don't adversely affect me very much. And I'm wondering whether there's any reason to have it looked at and taken care of now, as opposed to waiting until the symptoms actually become a problem. And I guess the second thing, is there anything I can do in terms of diet or other changes in lifestyle that might lessen the excess deposit of calcium that's showing up in my spinal cord?
Doctor?
So I'm not sure exactly what disease you actually have. It sounds like it could be something called ossification of the posterior longitudinal ligament, which would look like calcium in the ligaments compressing the spinal cord. And that's a disorder that's difficult to treat. You have to have surgery to decompress the spinal cord. What can be challenging is knowing where is the spinal cord most compressed and where is the compression causing the symptoms. And you could see the first surgery helped you. So they clearly had alleviated the compression the first time. The second time they did a second operation lower down, and maybe there's still some compression that is untreated. Having said that, it's definitely worthwhile to stick with a physician who's going to manage that and keep imaging it and keep looking for where the spinal cord is being compressed. Because if you wait too long, if you're unable to walk, for instance, because the legs are too weak, that doesn't always reverse when you have the surgery. And so So it's a give and take. You want to do the surgery not when somebody's fine, because then you're taking on risk for no apparent reason, but you don't want to wait too long either. So following closely with the physician on where the compression is and if it's progressing is very important.
Now, which physician, doc? In other words, is this your bailiwick, or is it a GP who does this? I mean, who do you go to do this work?
So particularly for this problem with a calcification there, that is best, I think, dealt with by a neurosurgeon who specializes in spinal surgery. There are orthopedic surgeons who also specialize in spinal surgery that can also take care of this. But really, a surgeon who takes on spinal surgery on a regular basis.
Okay, Ed, you got your answer. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Okay, let's go to Jim in Matamoros. Okay, Jim, you're on.
With respect to the phenomenon known as wind-up.
Wind-up. Have you heard of wind-up? He has not, nor have I, except in baseball. Thanks, Jim. Let's go to Brian in Hoosick. Brian in Hoosick, you're on.
Hi, Dr. Boulos. Thank you. I find the endovascular treatment of stroke is a really fascinating part of medicine. I myself am a physician. I have a question for you know, certainly if someone is unfortunate enough to have a stroke and they're near an academic medical center such as AMC, then that's good fortune for them that they can be treated where they're a dedicated stroke specialist. But what about for the, you know, vast regions of our country where they don't have dedicated stroke specialists, you know, in rural locations and other places? Do you think that to meet the need for treatment of stroke, particularly endovascular stroke, do you think we might look to physicians in other disciplines, for example, in cardiology, or how should we meet the needs for treating stroke properly?
That's a great question. And I think it's a difficult answer. What I can say is that in my mind, this is a lot like the trauma situation where you have level 1 trauma centers that take care of the multiple organ system trauma patient. It's a very specialized care. And it goes beyond just the physician doing that procedure. There's a lot of technology involved in the emergency room evaluation with a CT angiogram, a CT perfusion to select the right patients for the intervention. And then the post-operative care with the nursing is critical as well. So it's a long answer, but I think the outcomes will not be as good if you have other specialists who don't do this regularly treating this problem. And I think it will need to be centralized. And in rural areas, the traveling distance will be longer, but I think it will be worth it to have them still centralized at centers that really make this their expertise. Because
let's take me as a good example. Let's say it happens to me in Great Barrington, which is 1 hour away. You go to the emergency room, they should be able to spot what's going on fast enough and get me in an ambulance, right?
Right.
To you.
Or a helicopter, like they do with the trauma teams.
Yeah. Brian, that's a great question. I was sort of hinting at it before.
Okay, thank you. Thank you so much. Good
thanks
day.
Thanks a lot. Right.
Bye-bye.
Okay. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. Joanne in Niskayuna. Joanne, you're on.
My question is about aneurysm. Unfortunately, I come from a family where there have been 3 instances of aneurysm. And this is 2 cousins and 1 uncle. And there's no relationship between any of them. And I'm wondering if this is something that can be genetic, if it can run in families. And I might add that one of the cousins died in her 30s, and we were told at the time that she was born with this problem, and it was very unusual for somebody to live so long with it. And the other 2 people were much older. One was 79, one was 83. And I would also add that I have a heavy history of heart and stroke problems in this same family, and I'm wondering if this is related to the aneurysms.
Well, I think it's a great question, Joanne, and thank you for asking it. And the reason is that it scares the heck out of me. You know, the idea that these are really silent, hidden killers. Is there any way we can test ourselves for them?
Well, The answer to that is yes, absolutely. MR angiography, using the MRI machine to look at the blood vessels of the brain, it's, again, doesn't use radiation, and you don't have to have contrast for it, so it's very safe, and it'll pick up most aneurysms of the brain. And so it is a very useful screening tool in that scenario.
Everybody get one? I mean, you know, does Alan, who has never had any hint of it, go to the emergency room and say, get out your MRI?
The incidence is very low, and so we do not recommend screening everybody. And the other, so as I was going to get to, is in families like hers, though, it is worth screening, and we do screen. When we have because there is a genetic component to aneurysm formation. Aneurysms of the brain occur because the vessels are very thin-walled. And as I mentioned before, a lot of blood flow has to go to the brain. 25% of your output in the heart goes to the brain. And so it's prone to develop these really balloons or bubbles on the blood vessels. And there's a genetic link there that we don't fully understand that predisposes certain families to that. The other one is tobacco. Smoking is a very significant risk factor for the aneurysm formation and increases the risk of the aneurysm rupturing.
Now, Joanne certainly doesn't smoke, do you, Joanne?
Never.
Right.
Great.
I knew that.
My mother smoked, and she taught me by example that it's a terrible habit.
Okay.
That's great.
So what if you're exercising, Doc? I exercise a lot. Are you likely to force that rupture in a way that if you weren't working out?
I do not. So on patients who I know have aneurysms, I don't restrict their activities. I sometimes tell them not to skydive or scuba dive, but beyond that, I don't think there's a known risk from exercise that causes the aneurysm to rupture.
So what should Joanne do?
So getting the MRA as a screening test to make sure she doesn't have one is very reasonable. And we used to think that you were congenital and that you were born with them. I think increasingly we think they develop with time and in adulthood. There are cases where kids do have aneurysms, and usually those aneurysms look different. So there are congenital ones. But the most common one, the one that ruptures in our 30s, we think develops sometime in our teen years or 20s.
Do you remember those old... You remember the plastic things you used to buy, and then you took a little straw and you blew it up? You probably don't remember, Doc, but it was great. It was great stuff. It smelled great. And you put the little stuff at the end of the straw, and then you blew up a balloon, and then a little part of that would sometimes, you know, sort of come out. And that's what I think of when I think of aneurysms.
That's
probably an inappropriate observation, but what can I tell you? Hey, Joanne, that was a great call. Thank you so much for doing it.
Well, I can't say I like the answer, but I'm glad to know it. I'll try to take action on it. Thank you.
We'll go get an MRI. Goodbye.
Well, I would just add that, you know, very small aneurysms don't have to be treated. The risk of bleeding
is
very
right?
low. And as it relates to your point about the inflating plastic, when aneurysms have multiple lobes to it, those are the ones that may carry the highest risk for bleeding, and those are the ones we want to treat early. So I'm suggesting the MRA to her doesn't mean she needs to have it treated. We have to see if she has an aneurysm, and it may be one that doesn't need treatment.
So it's the bleeding that gets you, right?
That's right. Having an aneurysm 99% of the time doesn't hurt you. It's when it ruptures that it hurts you.
Cool. Okay, we got a lot of lines here open now. I know everybody's wanting to, but we're going to take a little break, and then we'll be right back. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551.
Support comes from the Urological Institute Urologic Oncology Services, prostate cancer specialists providing comprehensive care for all stages of prostate cancer, featuring a 3D diagnostic imaging and advanced robotics, urologyoncology.com. Ichiban Japanese and Chinese Restaurant, Central Avenue, Albany, Japanese, Chinese, and sushi bar. Dinner entrees served with soup, salad, and shrimp appetizer. Dine-in, takeout, delivery, 518-432-0358. Nathan Latour Hospital welcoming Dr. Alvarez, a gastroenterologist specializing in diseases of the digestive system, practicing in their new gastroenterology center in Johnstown, New York, accepting new patients, nlh.org. And from the Linda, WAMC's Performing Arts Studio, presenting a range of programming for the arts and community, thelinda.org.
And we're back with Dr. Alan Boulos. He's the chair of the neurosurgery department at Albany Medical Center, and he specializes in the surgical endovascular management of cerebrovascular disorders of the brain, that's stroke, aneurysm, vessel stenosis, and AVM. He has an expertise, in surgery for brain tumors. And the long, we have two free lines out of the five. Just want to keep you all involved. Okay, number two is from George from Chesapeake. Okay, Virginia. George, you're on.
Hey, good afternoon, doctors. I'll make this quick. I'm not really sure if it's related, but I fell off a four-foot ladder 2.5 years ago in 2013, and I was treated for a shattered right elbow, and I've had two nerve conduction tests on my right, one on my left, and my question, my feet, bottom of my feet are getting numb, and I'm wondering, when I fell and knocked myself and cut, and I was airlifted out of North Carolina. Could I have injured something in my brain or in my neck that's causing all this numbness and tingling, doctor?
Yeah, so I didn't quite hear the whole thing, but
yeah, you're breaking up a bit.
It sounds like you have your arms and legs are getting numb after this fall, and you could have injured your neck is what I'd be most worried about. The brain tends not to... if you injure the brain, it usually only affects one side of your body, not all four limbs. So the fact that it affects all four limbs concerns me about your neck. And so you can injure the ligaments or the bones in the neck, and that may have created some compression of the spinal cord, which can result in the numbness you're talking about.
Now, some diabetics get neuropathies of those kinds too, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. There's more than one cause. Just if this numbness really was a result of the fall, then that's a possibility. But you're right. There's lots of other causes for that.
Yeah. Hey, George, I've got to let you go. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Right. Let's go to Paul in Westfield. Okay, Paul, 1-800-348-2551. Paul, you're on.
Hi, doctor. The reason I'm calling in, I know this is a little out of your area of expertise, but I have been suffering with eustachian tube dysfunction for about 4 months now. It started back in May with a bad upper respiratory infection. I've been through treatment for an infection initially with antibiotics that cleared up the infection but didn't clear up the muffled sound and plugged ear feeling. I've been through prednisone treatment. That did nothing. I've seen two ENTs. They tell me I have a negative air pressure on the eardrum from fluid in the middle ear, and then I just have to tough it out, and eventually it'll resolve on its own. But I'm kind of at my wit's end at this point 4 months later.
So this was all a result of an infection, you said? It wasn't a
trauma?
Yeah,
I had a bad cold in early May and got an ear infection from it, and I got this, and this has happened to me in the past, and the ear gets plugged up, this plugged up feeling, and I can't pop it, and I'm getting on an airplane in 5 weeks, and I'm a little worried about the pressure change, and I don't know if I should be asking about other things at this point.
Have you had have you had an MRI looking at the ear?
No, they have not done that.
So, it is out of my specialty, so giving advice is probably not the best thing for me to do for this, but
What if your cousin called you?
Well, there are ear, nose, and throat surgeons that do a fellowship in ear, and maybe you've seen one, I don't know, but sometimes you can go to a fellowship-trained ear surgeon to get that looked at. The other is an MRI to make sure there's no inflammation of the nerve, which might explain why you're having the muffled sounds.
Okay.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right.
Yep.
Thanks.
We got two free phones. Now's the time. Let's go to Alice in Claremont. Okay, Alice, you are on. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Hello?
Hello.
Oh, okay. I am 71 years old, and I'm very active, 71 years old. I feel like I'm 30. I recently have been diagnosed with something called Binswanger's syndrome or disease, and it's my understanding that's a multi-infarct disease of the brain. Is that correct?
Yeah, the small vessels of the brain don't get enough blood flow and can cause strokes within the deep substance of the brain, and that can affect the connections.
Right, right. I have had TIAs. What I'm concerned about is I have been having, I have a history of migraines, and the other day I had three migraines, and it always starts in my neck. I am pretty incapacitated. My mental status is a little off. I'm very uncomfortable. And it goes up to my brain, to the front, my forehead, and I'm in a lot of pain. And it lasts, well, the longest it ever lasts was 15 minutes, but the three times in a day it lasted about 5 minutes. And I'm concerned about that.
Okay.
And I don't, can you tell me what that could be, or is it related to what's going on in my brain?
No, I think they're separate. The Biswanger's or the multi-infarct disease process is one that's usually not painful. It can affect memory and affect other symptoms, but it doesn't usually create pain.
Right.
The pain, it's hard for me to know for sure, but sometimes when pain emanates from the neck, there can be arthritis, particularly in the upper cervical spine, and it can affect the nerves that go into the scalp,
uh-huh.
and that can cause pretty severe, sharp pains that go up from the neck into the back of the head.
Okay, all right. Just one more thing. I've had other major symptoms that took me to the hospital, which is my inability to walk, which also lasted about 10 minutes. And then I had left-sided weakness, and I went to the ER. They ruled out stroke. I didn't have one, and they were this is all irrelevant because they were thinking about MS because I have periventricular white matter disease.
Yeah, so, I mean, those are all in the same differential. So
right.
I don't know that you're going to have Biswanger's and MS. It's probably
no,
one
I don't
or the
have
other.
It.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't have it.
Listen, I'm so sorry, Alice, but we got a lot of people behind you. Thank you for calling.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. Yeah, bye. Okay, let's go to John in Hyde Park. Okay, John, you're on.
Hi there. I have a quick question. About every other week or so, I will be having a normal day. And then in the middle of my field of vision, I get visual kind of a crinkling, like someone wrinkled up saran wrap. And then over the course of the next hour or so, it turns slowly into a halo. Sometimes it does manifest with headache pain afterwards, and sometimes there's no pain at all. It's just that visual effect. And it actually doesn't help with driving very much, as you might imagine.
Yeah.
So I was wondering if you can tell me what this is. My ophthalmologist said it was a visual migraine.
It sounds like it when it follows with the headache. That's classic for visual migraine. And sometimes with visual migraines, you only get the aura, the visual experience, without the headache. So it very well could be. Your ophthalmologist hopefully looked for things like retinal issues, which can cause that saran wrap appearance to the vision. So presumably he looked at that or she looked at that.
He did.
Yeah.
John, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. Let's go to Louise in Sunderland. Louise, you're on.
Hi, Alan, and hi, Dr. Bullis.
Both
hi,
Alans.
How are you?
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm a hospitalist in a small hospital in your hearing area, and I spend a lot of time in the emergency room. Unfortunately, we do not have a neurologist or a neurosurgeon, and the nearest center is an hour away. So when a patient comes in with major symptoms suggestive of stroke, we do a CT scan to be certain it's not a hemorrhagic or bleeding stroke, and also go through the criteria for delivering thrombolytics or clot-busting medicines. And very few patients fulfill those criteria. And we're encouraged to keep those patients in our hospital, no matter the age or the degree of their symptoms. And next day, they get an MRA. Some of them see a teleneurologist. But my question is, are we really safe to keep people with us who we don't look at their angiographic studies until the next day?
That's a great question. The reality is some of those patients probably would stand to benefit from an endovascular procedure. So with IVTPA, as you suggested, it's a very low number that can actually have that treatment because there's a narrow group of indications. In particular, you have to be within 4.5 hours of the stroke onset. And also, there's a lot on the blood pressure needs to be under control, can't have prior blood thinners, can't have recent surgery because you don't want bleeding to be complicated, whereas those are not contraindications or problems for the endovascular procedure. So I think it's going to change that patients with significant neurological symptoms and signs are going to need imaging of their vessels or transfer to a place that can do the endovascular procedure on evaluation. Now, if a patient comes in with over a day of symptoms, that patient may not need to be...
Well, sure.
Right. But within 6 hours, evaluation of the vessels has to be done in a very timely way for those patients.
So why not do the MRI the night before? Why do you wait for the next day?
Well,
the MRI is not
available.
Online.
Usually it's not available emergently.
Yeah.
It needs to be done within minutes.
Yeah.
An MRI takes a long time to do. If a patient's unstable, it's a little scary to send them to the MRI machine.
Right. So at Albany, we do something called a CT angiogram. So they give the intravenous contrast and look at the large vessels of the brain to see if there's a blockage.
So your thought then might be that when these patients come in, instead of just a CT to look for a hemorrhagic stroke, we should be trying to do a CTA.
At the same time would be the best thing.
And a CPA, again, for a CT
angiogram.
Yeah, okay.
It's a CAT scan looking at the blood vessels of the brain.
Right. And for those who don't know what a hospitalist is, which are many, it's the new look. It's the person in the hospital who takes care of everybody.
It's not that new, Alan.
Yeah. Well, I'm old. I'm old. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Bye. 1-800-348-2551. We've got a Julia in Albany. Julia.
Hi. My sister, at the age of 60, she's now 67, started having stroke-like symptoms. They never really said it was a large stroke, maybe a TIA. She then started having seizures, and in her MRI, they said it may be related to her birthmark, maybe Sturge-Weber syndrome. She's declined. She was also diagnosed at that age, I think about a year or two later, with schizophrenia, which is just odd. And she's in a nursing home, and she's never really had an official diagnosis of Sturge-Weber. She has a port wine stain birthmark over her left eye that has gotten increasingly darker and lighter at different times. So a lot of people are telling me it's not important to have her diagnosed as Sturge-Weber syndrome. So I was wondering what your expertise in this area might be and if that's important. They said they're treating her symptoms, and that's all that matters.
And, Doc, would you explain to everybody what Sturge-Weber is?
Sturge-Weber is a condition that affects the port wine stain is abnormal vessels within the skin, just underneath the skin. It often is associated with brain abnormalities, including AVMs and other vascular abnormalities. So it can cause neurological problems because not enough blood flow is getting to parts of the brain, or the AVM could be causing the seizures, as it is maybe in her case. So I understand that they're treating the seizures with medications and they're treating the schizophrenia with medications, but I do think it probably would help to have a more formal evaluation of whether she indeed has that condition, and also to make sure that there isn't a treatable cause for those conditions. Schizophrenia can be more pronounced because of a neurologic problem, because some areas of the brain are ischemic, and if you change the flow, you can sometimes help. So
once again, ischemic means?
Not getting enough blood flow.
Okay.
So I think it's worth investigating.
Yeah. Julia, thanks for calling. We're trying to get everybody in. I appreciate your patience. Thanks a lot.
Yep, bye-bye.
Okay, let's go to Carolyn in South Egremont. Okay, Carolyn, you're on.
Okay, thank you. My question is about the relationship between chemotherapy and the possible damage it does to blood vessels. I had extensive chemo 15 years ago and have of late been breaking blood vessels in my hands very easily where the blood will pool in my fingers.
Okay, it's a great question, Carolyn. I don't want to give you the rush, but let's go
to
the doctor.
That's okay.
Go ahead,
Doc.
Yeah, so it is a great question. I can't answer for sure how it's affecting the hand vessels. We do see there are some cases where chemotherapy may be related to brain aneurysms, but again, it's like you said, maybe a late effect. We're not sure. Also, with radiation, can also affect the vessels. It's the opposite. It often causes stenosis or occlusion of the vessels with radiation. So late effects of chemotherapy are something that we're increasingly having to learn and deal with. And I think, depending on the condition, depending on what the problem is, there are different treatments.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, we'll go to Ellen in Buckland. Okay, Ellen in Buckland, you're on.
Yeah, my question is about the glioblastoma of the brain. Any thoughts on medical marijuana for that? I know somebody who seems to be having good success with it.
I can't speak to that. I think medical marijuana is effective as a nausea agent, and that can sometimes have a lot to do with glioblastoma patients. So if it's for prevention of emesis and to improve appetite, it can be very useful. But how it works to slow the growth of a glioblastoma or get it to go away, I have not read that, so I can't answer the question.
Thank you, Ellen. Okay, we'll go to Maria in East Hampton. Maria, you're on.
Hi. Many years ago, I started having stroke-like symptoms, had them very regularly, and had a lot of testing, but it wasn't until the internet came that we found out that they were basilar artery migraines. Mm-hmm. And that was because there was enough people who were having them, and they talked to each other over the internet. They since have begun to be called, I believe, basilar type migraines. One of the question I have is my symptoms, the stroke-like symptoms, usually mostly disappear within 24 hours, but I have a lot of leftover weakness and lack of coordination in my hand and in my leg. I'm curious if you know about it and what you know about it.
Yeah, so that's a great question. Migraines, as was mentioned earlier with the ocular migraines, they can be neurologic signs and symptoms that look a lot like a stroke. It could be, in the case of a basilar artery, it can cause double vision, it can cause numbness around the mouth, it can cause trembling or incoordination of your arms and legs, and that's where that phrase comes from, because when the basilar artery, one of the main arteries in the back of the brain, is narrowed and not enough blood flow is going through it, those are the typical symptoms. And with a migraine, we still, I don't think, fully understand, is there a true vasoconstriction that results in these symptoms and then the headache with the vasodilatation that comes on later? And so some people use...
I don't get a headache with this at all.
Yeah, and so that's, as I had mentioned earlier, with the ocular migraine, some patients never get that headache. They just get the ocular symptoms and no headache associated with it. I guess I'd be cautious. If the symptoms persist, then I think making sure that there's no blockage in the basilar artery, that it's there's no narrowing in the vertebral arteries, which are the arteries that run through the neck and join up to form the basilar artery. You want to be sure that that's not inadvertently the cause of your symptoms rather than the vasospasm possibility.
Yeah. They did all that testing.
And it was fine.
Yeah, it was fine.
And do you take a vasodilator to try and reduce the frequency of it or no?
I take Depakote.
Okay, and that helps?
It does. Yeah, I used to have several a day, and now I have them. Well, I'm much older now, so after I went through menopause, I started to have fewer and fewer of them.
Well, that's good. That goes along with Depakote is an anti-seizure medicine, and it's also been found to work very well for migraine.
Well, Maria, thank you very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Ben.
All right, we are out of time. We're going to have to leave Hillary from Lenox on the air, on the board here, because we just don't have enough time to properly answer another question. I want to thank everyone who called in today and apologize to Hillary. I'd also like to thank Dr. Alan Boulos for joining us today. He's a busy man. He's the chair of his department and obviously much in demand. Thanks again, everybody, for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Joe Makowitz, who did a terrific job. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein-Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.